be a lingering, unnerving scent of smoke, along with burned wood and other synthetic materials. Georgiou was all but certain the air would also reek of the haunting odor of scorched flesh. All of this, she knew, carried the potential to act as emotional triggers. Kurapati moved to one of the windows on the room's far side.
There is a pretty large gathering out there. 100 people, at least.
Stepping away from the podium, Ribeiro made her way to the room's far wall, where a table had been arranged with carafes of water as well as dispensers for tea and coffee. The lack of food was noticeable, and though there was a food processor set into the wall above the table, it was a subtle yet practical way of reminding Georgiou about the food crisis that, though being addressed with the Narvon's arrival, was still very much a serious consideration.
"Some of those people have been there since before sunrise," replied Ribeiro as she helped herself to a cup of tea. "I wish I could say they were all supporters celebrating my return to office, but I know better."
Crossing the room to stand next to Kurapati, Georgiou saw the assemblage of citizens from her vantage point 3 stories above the street running in front of the governor's building. The people were not a single mass, but instead broken into small groups of varying size. Some talked among themselves, while many more stood in silence, staring at the building as though waiting for something to happen.
"I know I've repeated this several times already," said Ribeiro, "but I can't thank you enough for being here. Now that people are realizing the Federation and Starfleet never abandoned them, it's my hope that we'll all find a way to work through this together."
Georgiou said,
"From what we've been led to understand, it's not being abandoned by the Federation that has so many people upset. Quite the opposite, in fact."
"That's true."
Ribeiro sighed.
"There will be many who ultimately blame the Federation for what happened to us. Many of those descended from the original settlers, and quite a few more who came later live here because of what Tarsus IV has always represented. A life of independence and self-determination."
"Every Federation world enjoys that same right," said Kurapati. "It's been a fundamental component since the beginning."
Teacup and saucer in hand, Ribeiro replied,
"But then that same Federation comes here and tells us that they're taking away part of our planet and giving it to a group of outsiders. A large group of outsiders, larger than the community that was already here."
Before Kurapati could respond, the governor held up a hand.
"Don't misunderstand me, Captain. Bringing the Epsilon Sirona refugees here after the disaster that befell their world was a correct humanitarian thing to do. But there were those among us who saw it as a gross overreach of power by people light years away, who hold no regard for the lives we've made for ourselves here."
"Yet you agreed with it," said Georgiou.
While the Narbon was in transit, she reviewed the speeches Ribeiro presented to the people of Tarsus IV, explaining the dire situation on Epsilon Sirona II and the need to transfer its 6,000 inhabitants from that colony to here. The governor's impassioned plea to her constituents was compelling, but it did not protect her from all manner of pundits representing a number of publications and news programs who took issue with the relocation. Some expressed concern that the rushed process might have unintended harmful effects, not just for the original Tarsus IV residents, but also the refugees.
"Turns out those people might not have been so far off after all."
Ribeiro said,
"It was the only rational option, even setting aside the fact that Tarsus IV is not an independent world, but instead a Federation colony and protectorate. Even if I had the power to do so, I wasn't about to tell the Federation to take their problems somewhere else. There was no reason to deny the request, but my point was that it was never a request. It was a decision made by someone else, implemented by someone else, and put into motion without even a passing attempt at respecting the sovereign status of this planet or my authority as its duly elected leader."
She looked to Captain Kurapati.
"So let's kindly dispense with the lectures about core Federation values. They're of precious little use to me at the moment."
Her words were flat and icy, matching the momentary flash of anger in her eyes. It was the first time Georgiou had seen genuine emotion from the governor since arriving on Tarsus IV. Having all but forgotten the tea she prepared, she set the cup and saucer back on the table before returning her gaze to Georgiou and Kurapati.
Yes, I accepted the relocation, because it was the right thing to do, and I convinced the Leadership Council to back me. Then we pitched it to the rest of the colony. There were a few objections, mostly about the need to verify that anything brought from Epsilon Serona II wouldn't present a danger to us. I shared those concerns with the Federation and Starfleet, and they did the usual round of studies and checks that are always done when you blend elements of disparate ecosystems.
She paused, shaking her head.
Obviously, that wasn't enough.
So, when the contagion began, people blamed you, said Koropati.
Ribeiro nodded. Not everyone, but enough. Despite the initial resistance to the relocation and their desire to be left alone, these are good people. It was the suddenness of the change that upset them. Still, there was that percentage of people who were never going to agree with me about anything. You know how politics works. From the instant you enter this arena, you always have those people who will never support you, but instead will find every opportunity to tear you down.
Crossing her arms, Giorgio said, "The early confusion and indecision, or at least their perception of indecision, couldn't have helped."
We were just figuring out what to do.
Ribeiro scowled, casting her gaze around the room.
I've dealt with emergency situations before, but nothing on this scale. We had 8,000 people depending on us to make the right choices and see them through the crisis. We were all conscious about screwing it up, but I never had any chance to really do anything. We were still getting our feet under us when Kodos convinced the council to push for a no-confidence vote. And there was nothing I could do.
Giorgio asked, "But why bring someone like Kodos in your inner circle? He was a known voice of dissent regarding the relocation, was he not?" She already knew the answer to the question, having reviewed what limited information was on file for Adrian Kodos.
"I didn't bring him in," replied Ribeiro as she began pacing the room. "I'd never even met him before this all started, but he was friends with a few of the council members, and he had experience dealing with emergencies."
She shook her head.
"I'm still waiting to hear what exact situations he dealt with. Part of me thinks it was a ruse so that he could move into position to take over. He certainly didn't waste any time turning several of the council members against me."
Reaching the window, she looked out at the gathering Giorgio knew was still there.
"And after all of that, they had no problem putting me back in charge to deal with the aftermath of what he did."
Crossing the room toward her, Giorgio said,
"Governor, one of the things I've been ordered to determine is whether a full evacuation of the planet is the best option for everyone involved. Before, when it was just a contagion, there was an argument to be made for defeating the infection and helping the colony get back on its feet, but now, the massacre will hang over everything you try to do here. There will still be people who blame you, not just for the outbreak, but for what Kodos did. They'll argue that if you hadn't accepted the Epsilon Serona refugees, Kodos would never have been in a position to do what he did."
"They lay the whole thing at your feet," added Koropati.
Ribeiro turned from the window.
"All those people can go to hell. We have real problems to solve, and we need real solutions. You and your people represent those solutions, Captain, and with your help, we'll get through this."
"It won't be easy," said Giorgio.
"Nothing worth doing ever is."
The governor smiled.
"If anything, it's that attitude that exemplifies this planet and its people. This colony wasn't founded because it would be easy. The people who came here knew what they were getting into, but their hopes and dreams were enough to fuel them. Getting past this tragedy won't be easy, but they'll want that chance to try. Yes, we must find and apprehend those who supported Kodos or who aided in the massacre, but I have to believe the majority of those still with us want nothing more than to live in peace and to put this terrible ordeal behind them. They deserve that chance."
Giorgio could not help thinking that if Ribeiro had put forth this level of confidence from the outset of the crisis, events might have unfolded in far different fashion. Even now, after returning to her office, some news broadcasts continued to attack her. Polls, supposedly taken to gauge public sentiment, showed an alarming percentage of people who preferred to condemn Ribeiro for the executions rather than Kodos. What Georgiou wondered was how many people sat in silent solidarity with him. There had to be some, even if they played no actual role in carrying out Kodos's plan. As for the governor, she could be criticized for her lack of experience in the face of the calamity affecting her people, and even her early indecision as she struggled to formulate a course of action. But her concern for the well-being of those she was elected to lead was palpable.
"I know it will be difficult," said Ribeiro after a moment. "There were several arrests made soon after your landing, along with a number of assaults. Our hospital was already stretching its resources to the limit with the previous day's influx of patients, but this new surge has caught them all off guard."
"I have already sent our medical team to the hospital, Governor," said Koropati, "and we have equipment and supplies being moved into position as well."
Upon being briefed on the hospital's most pressing needs, Dr. Vazhdinsky shifted into high gear, dispatching the medical staff assembled by Admiral Anderson back at Starbase 11. Three doctors, along with a team of nurses and even a handful of field medics, were already on scene and contributing to the triage and treatment for more than 200 patients. Georgiou could not help but be impressed by the doctor's speed and organization as he put into motion his components of the assistance plan.
"And we also have teams deployed to the main food processing facilities," said Georgiou. "Neutralizing the contamination is the first priority, including machinery used to convert the raw food compounds. Decontaminating farms, hydroponics facilities, and food processors in residences and other buildings will take longer, but we have plenty of rations aboard the Narbonne to cover the gap while that work proceeds."
Colony scientists had made progress isolating the source of the fungal infection. Developing a counteragent was proving to be a greater challenge, but early reports from agricultural specialists brought in with the ship were encouraging.
"I appreciate everything you've done already," said Ribeiro, "and everything you'll be doing in the days ahead. Your response to all of this has been amazing. We will never be able to properly show our gratitude."
Koropati said,
"We are just the first wave, Governor. Other ships are on the way. At last report, the next one won't be here for at least 2 weeks. Starfleet has been scrambling all available resources, but it's still a lot of space to cover."
He smiled.
"Until then, you'll have to put up with us."
"Gladly."
The room's front entrance opened to reveal one of Ribeiro's assistants. An older man. His weathered features were framed by close-cropped gray hair, and he wore a simple blue civilian ensemble that seemed to Georgiou a bit formal for the current situation. Then, thoughts about his fashion sense were shattered as Georgiou caught sight of his right hand and the dark cylinder it held.
"Grenade!"
She uttered the warning as she saw the man's arm cock back to throw the object. Instinct took over and she lunged toward Ribeiro, who was reacting to the shout of alarm before Georgiou slammed into her and forced her to the floor. Koropati was also moving for the governor, and the three of them ended up in a tangled heap. Twisting her body, Georgiou was looking for the grenade to come bouncing into the room, but instead saw the man's attack thwarted by the appearance of a second person. Another human male dressed in civilian clothing had lunged into view, covering the other man's hand with his own and preventing him from throwing or dropping the grenade. Lean and muscled, the new arrival punched the would-be attacker in the side of his head, trying to subdue him. The first man grunted in obvious pain, struggling as they both held the grenade between them. He reached with his free hand for his opponent's throat, but the second man was faster, landing another vicious punch to his rival's head.
"Stay here!"
snapped Georgiou, pushing away from Ribeiro and Koropati and moving toward the scuffle. She was too late to offer any help as their apparent savior landed a third brutal punch to his adversary's head. The first man collapsed, sagging against the nearby wall before sliding down to the floor. All the while, the new arrival kept his grip tight on the grenade until he had it free of the other man's hand. That accomplished, he studied the device before pressing a recessed control, deactivating it. Making eye contact with Georgiou, he offered her the grenade.
Pretty rude way to say hello, don't you think?
Wary of a second attack, Georgiou said nothing until a pair of security guards arrived to take the unconscious intruder into custody before shifting their attention to the other man. Returning to Ribeiro, Georgiou placed her hand on the other woman's shoulder.
Governor, are you all right?
Ribeiro nodded in response, as did Koropati when Georgiou checked on him.
He's one of my most trusted aides, said the governor as they watched the security officers pull the man to his feet.
You might want to think about firing him, Georgiou offered.
We got lucky, said Koropati, but we need to do a better job of screening for weapons and other devices. My security people can help with that.
Georgiou said, there's something else to consider. We may not be able to trust every member of the colony's security force.
Kodos, said Ribeiro. You think some of the officers may still be loyal to him?
Somebody let that guy in here with a grenade.
Koropati added,
and some were involved in the execution. Others likely helped him hide, and eventually escape.
If there are Kodos supporters among the civilian populace, there will damn sure be some within the colony government, including others among your staff, Governor.
It was a terrible thing even to consider, but Georgiou knew they had to weigh all the possibilities. Anyone who backed Kodos for whatever reason would be taking steps to conceal their identity and affiliations in the hopes of evading arrest. Reaching up to wipe tears from her eyes, Ribeiro released a heavy sigh.
It's been difficult maintaining my composure, even just with my staff. And now this. Everyone, including me, lost someone that night. My fiancé was one of those chosen. I didn't even know until I was released from the cell where Kodos's people threw us.
She drew a deep breath, wiping one last tear from her right eye before looking once more to Koropati and Georgiou.
Can you help us find him? And anyone who assisted him?
I volunteer for that duty, Governor.
The answer came from a voice near the room's entrance, and Georgiou saw that the man who had arrived in the nick of time was back, no longer flanked by members of the governor's security detail. Only then did Georgiou realize she recognized him.
Lieutenant Commander Gabriel Lorca, the man said, offering a formal nod first to Ribeiro, then to Koropati and Georgiou.
He gestured to two new arrivals, a man and a woman, who stood just outside the room in the adjoining passageway.
Along with the remains of my team, reporting as ordered, Captain.
His expression flat, he added,
Welcome to Tarsus IV, sir. With your permission, I'd like to hunt down Adrian Kodos and bring him to justice.
11. After two previous attempts to reheat it, the tea had lost its flavor and no longer held any appeal for him. With a grunt of disgust, Kodos tossed the metal cup's bland contents against the cave wall. Watching the tea run down and into the cracks within the rock, he shook his head at his own temper and stupidity.
Do you feel better?
Drawing a deep breath, Kodos considered his surroundings. Though he had never believed himself to be claustrophobic or otherwise troubled by confined spaces, he tried not to buy into the notion that the walls of the underground caverns were indeed closing in around him.
You're being silly, he said to no one.
Governor? Someone asked.
Startled that he was no longer alone, Kodos turned toward the mouth of the small cave serving as his private quarters to see a younger man studying him. In the dim light provided by the portable lamp, it took him a moment to recognize Joel Pekaski regarding him from near shadow. Dressed in a drab green jumpsuit of the sort favored by pilots and others who worked around vehicles or other large machinery, the security detachment commander was a quiet man perhaps 10 years younger than Kodos. Pekaski preferred to shave his head, a practice Kodos had witnessed earlier in the day, and he was renowned among the security forces for the intense exercise regimen he followed almost without fail each morning.
My tea and I were having a disagreement, Joel, said Kodos, forcing a smile. What can I do for you?
Pekaski pointed a thumb behind him.
Charlene has finished linking into the information network. We're able to receive broadcasts.
Excellent.
One of the drawbacks to hiding in the mountains well away from New Anchorage was the lack of communication or other connection to the city.
Despite his preparations that included this refuge and the supplies they acquired to sustain them and his eventual departure from the planet, his plans were disrupted by the arrival of the relief ship far ahead of estimates. This resulted in a number of tasks being completed in hurried fashion. From the moment it became obvious Kodos and his people would have to flee New Anchorage, the transport of personnel and equipment began. A caravan of ground vehicles, loaded and positioned well outside the city, was waiting for them after Kodos gave the withdrawal order. Bukowski had not been able to secure everything they wanted to take with them, but the equipment already on the vehicles provided a decent start. The journey to the mountains was slow and circuitous in a bid to avoid detection. Once here, however, hiding became somewhat simpler, owing to geomagnetic instabilities throughout the region. These anomalies would interfere with sensors and transporters, making it difficult for anyone hunting them. On the one hand, the mountain range's natural properties made it an obvious choice for a hiding place. However, anyone conducting a search here would have to do so the hard way, on foot or by ground vehicle, giving Kodos and his people the advantage of anticipating the arrival of any unwanted guests. He accompanied Bukowski to the larger cavern, which acted as a command post. Equipment and work tables were scattered in something resembling a circle around a larger table that held a quartet of portable computer workstations. Stored along the cave walls were packing containers, most able to be carried by a single person, that contained food rations as well as medical and other supplies. The chamber felt in many respects like a military camp, though Kodos himself had no experience with such things. He suspected this was Pekaski's doing, in keeping with the man's past as a Starfleet Ground Forces officer.
"Did you have trouble obtaining the other supplies?" asked Kodos.
Bukowski shrugged. "It was a challenge, but we managed. If we go back again, there could be problems. The Starfleet ship is already working with the security forces to keep things under control. You can be sure they'll be monitoring anyone entering or leaving the city."
"Then it's a good thing we know the city better than they do."
New Anchorage, being an open city on a planet where crime was low and civil unrest all but unknown, did not possess any sort of barriers to entry. Even the spaceport, the most controlled area in the region, allowed entry to the city once new arrivals were processed through the colony's immigration support center. All of that changed with the onset of the fungal infection, first with Governor Ribeiro enacting curfews, and later when Kodos instituted martial law. Even with the arrival of the Starfleet vessel and others still on the way, extra security measures remained in place throughout the city. A curfew remained in place, and access to certain sensitive areas around the city was still restricted. Bukowski, leading a small group of people back to the city in order to abscond with some needed supplies, was able to learn much about the current security situation.
"I think we'll still be able to get in and out undetected," said Bukowski. "We'll just have to pick our entry points and times very carefully. Plus, I've already got some people looking into whether we can worm our way into the Starfleet ship's sensor feeds without being detected. Assuming we can pull it off, that'll be a big help."
Kodos nodded in approval.
"Impressive. You obviously have some training and skills that aren't listed in your personnel file with the security forces."
With a knowing smile, Bukowski replied,
"I learned a long time ago that as long as no one asks the pertinent question, choosing not to share certain things isn't really lying."
"Situational morality, Joel?"
"All morality is situational, Governor."
"Indeed."
Crossing the cave floor to the cluster of portable computer terminals sitting atop the central table, Kodos moved to stand behind a young woman working at one station while sitting on a folding camp stool. It took him a moment to recall that her name was Charlene Schmidt, daughter to another of the security officers who had rallied to his cause. She was perhaps too young for this life, Kodos decided, but it was still gratifying to see people her age supporting their cause.
"I'm told we are able to receive broadcasts thanks to your efforts," he said,
and the young woman shifted on her stool so that she could face him.
"That's right, Governor. It took some doing, but I've been able to patch into the data feeds being transmitted between New Anchorage and the outlying settlements. We can monitor anything that comes across them, and they'll never know we're watching."
Bukowski added,
We recorded a news broadcast that aired just a few minutes ago. It's something you'll want to see. To Schmidt, he said, "Cue it up."
Pressing a string of keys on her terminal's console, Schmidt called up a visual log before moving to her right in order to give Kodos and Pekaski an unobstructed view of her computer's display. On the screen, a middle-aged man in civilian attire sat behind a desk on the familiar stage of one of New Anchorage's prominent broadcast news providers.
"The arrival of the Starfleet ship Narbonne appears to be lifting spirits across the city. Though colony security continues to report instances of civil unrest, including vandalism and assaults against citizens, those incidents look to be on the decline. Many people remain understandably upset by the events of recent days, and community leaders are demanding answers, even as Governor Ribeiro and her staff continue their efforts at keeping things under control. Security commanders stress that everything possible is being done to rein in these protests, while praising the community for their efforts to help them minimize further injuries to persons or damage to property."
Kodos knew from the moment he first conceived of the sacrifice that implementing it would come with repercussions. Stunned at first by the scope and audacity of what he had put into motion, the remaining colony population seemed to undergo something of a delayed reaction to the reality of what was done. In fact, the resulting displays of unrest and retaliation against figures or symbols of authority or just one another ended up being more subdued than what he expected. He was both surprised and relieved. Might it mean on some level that a segment of the remaining population at least understood, if not outright approved of, the drastic actions undertaken to ensure the colony's survival?
"One can only wonder and hope."
On the computer screen, the newscaster continued. "Around the colony, members of the Starfleet Assistance Team are digging in and working hard on a variety of tasks. Medical personnel are on hand, assisting the staff of New Anchorage Hospital to treat the patients they've received in the wake of ongoing protests and other acts of civil unrest. Foremost among these is the eradication of the fungus that contaminated our food supplies and endangered us all. Reports on this front indicate the science and engineering specialists are close to a solution, which will allow food processing and delivery facilities to be brought back online. In the meantime, citizens are encouraged to visit one of the designated locations in order to receive food rations brought by the Narbonne, all of which have been verified as not affected by the contamination. Efforts to develop a way to defeat the contagion are ongoing." Kodos reached for the computer interface and pressed the control to pause the playback. He let his hand remain on the terminal, and only after a few moments did he realize he was propping himself with his arm.
"Governor?" he heard Pekaski prompting. "Are you all right?"
Had he really just sagged against the table? For a handful of fleeting seconds, the strength seemed to ebb from his body. The sensation faded with the same abruptness that it appeared, leaving him to wonder if there was something physically wrong with him, or was this a form of mental malaise that had chosen to manifest itself?
Guilt?
Of course. He felt remorse at the necessity of the sacrifice. How was anyone to know assistance would arrive so much sooner than originally estimated? Should he have waited, exercising greater prudence before carrying out his final decision? Perhaps, but no amount of second-guessing would undo what happened. There was only the future to contemplate, both for the colony and for himself. Without answering Pekaski, Kodos touched the control to resume the playback. "Also continuing are efforts to locate and detain Adrian Kodos, who authorities report has not been seen since the night of the mass executions at the amphitheater. Officials asked for comment on the manhunt indicate they are following a number of leads, but they've had no luck even ascertaining his last known location. There are rival theories as to Kodos's whereabouts, with some believing he's still hiding somewhere in New Anchorage, while others think he's fled the city, likely with the assistance of at least some of the individuals who helped him carry out the merciless executions."
"They can look all they want," said Pekaski. "They won't find us, sir."
Kodos did not believe the other man, but saw no reason to diminish his confidence, at least not in front of subordinates. There would be time enough later to discuss contingencies. Complicating matters is the fact that very few people seem to even know what Kodos looks like, and most of the colony administrative staff, with the notable exception of Governor Ribeiro and a few council members, did not survive the executions. A preliminary examination of colony computer records reveals that all imagery of Kodos has been deleted, suggesting he sought to complicate efforts to search for him before making his escape. Authorities are asking for assistance from the community and for anyone with information pertaining to Kodos to please come forward.
That's enough.
He indicated for Schmidt to stop the broadcast. Thanking the woman for her assistance, he gestured to Pekaski, and the two men began walking among the work tables and stacks of supplies and equipment.
They will not stop looking for me, he said, keeping his voice low. The public will demand my capture and trial. For all we know, people will look for me on their own, and justice will be far from their minds while they hunt for me.
Hunt for us. Pekaski regarded him with an expression of unfettered conviction. You're not alone, Governor. They're hunting all of us. The man's devotion was admirable, and Kodos was moved by his assurances. If and when the time came to confront pursuers, be they interested in justice or vengeance, Kodos knew full well that he may be forced to make some difficult choices. The people who had sworn allegiance to him could find themselves placed in the position of choosing between him and their own freedom or well-being. Left with no other alternatives, how many of these people would sacrifice themselves? He was certain that Pekaski, Ian Galloway, and a handful of others would. But the rest? There was no way to be sure. The situation had turned drastic with the Starfleet ship's arrival, and what seemed so clear and righteous just days earlier now was consumed by doubt. His own choices were simple. Kodos needed to plan for the worst. If he was to have any measure of peace, he likely would have to discard everything about his current life and identity and begin anew. A simple getaway by fleeing off-world was not a viable option, at least at present. The Starfleet captain and his crew would be expecting something like that and taking appropriate precautions to prevent his escape. Even getting to a transport would be all but impossible, with the spaceport under close watch and those few ships occupying berths prohibited from departing without extreme screening.
We can't wait for opportunity to present itself, Joel. We must act in order to maintain control of our situation for as long as possible.
Pekaski replied, We need to stay ahead of whoever they send to find us. Seize the initiative instead of waiting for them to come to us. Better yet, we can disrupt their work with the colony. Divide their attention, divert their focus.
Exactly.
As they continued their stroll, Kodos waited until they were past a cluster of six men and women, each working to unload supplies from a trio of packing containers. He said nothing until he was sure they were out of earshot.
There's something else to consider. Blending back in with the population may be our best option. Perhaps if we waited until the initial searches for me are completed, the rest of you should have no problem. On the other hand, I'll have to take prudent steps.
Knowing there was no obvious means for him to escape the planet, the Starfleet teams rendering assistance to the colony would search the entire planet for him. Assuming he did nothing, they would find him sooner or later. Even with whatever ended up passing for a fair trial in a Federation court, there was no chance he would escape conviction or incarceration. He had no intention of spending the rest of his days consigned to a penal colony, or, worse, a psychiatric facility such as the remote planet Elva II, an asylum for the criminally insane and other miscreants viewed as unsuited for existence in the idyllic paradise the Federation had labored to create. Once banished to such a place, he would become an object of scrutiny and scorn, doomed to endless questioning, study, and judgment by doctors, curiosity seekers, and other weaker beings.
Never.
Kodos would die before he allowed that to happen. How many people would have to die along with him? 12. The window shattered, sending an expanding cloud of glass shards along with the brick responsible for it into the hallway. People, some of them injured along with others who accompanied them to the hospital, scrambled for cover. One man, older and slower than those around him, was the unfortunate target of the brick which struck him in the head. Grunting in pain, he stumbled to the other side of the corridor before sagging against the far wall and sliding to the floor.
"Help! I need help over here!"
Giorgio was running for the fallen man even as she shouted. Pushing past people who had ducked away from the window and now were packed into the corridor's confined space, she did not reach him until he had settled into a heap on the floor. He was leaning against the wall, his arms hanging limp at his sides as his chin rested against his chest. Blood ran from a wound where the brick struck his head, and Giorgio could see the indentation in the right side of his skull marking the point of impact.
"What the hell is going on out there?"
she snapped at a Narbonne security guard who was running toward the nearest exit. The younger officer paused, his eyes wide with concern.
"Some kind of protest outside, Commander. Apparently a few members of the colony's governing council are here in the hospital, and there are a number of people out there who are upset about it."
His gaze seemed to fix on the fallen man.
"I guess people are looking for someone to blame for what happened. Things took a turn, but colony security people are already on it. We're heading outside to help."
"Be careful out there,"
offered Giorgio before returning her attention to her latest patient. How many people had she treated in the last 6 hours? She quit counting after she ran out of fingers. It was all she could do to keep up, doing her best to assist the New Anchorage hospital staff and the Narbonne medical staff. With everyone shorthanded and little time for any single point of focus, Giorgio and the rest of the relief team found themselves doubling and even tripling up in order to carry out various tasks regardless of individual expertise. Trained years ago as a field medic, Giorgio quickly found herself lending a hand with the triage activities both here at the hospital and at the emergency treatment stations set up at a school gymnasium a short walk from here. Setting aside her supervisory duties as she tried to keep track of various Narbonne personnel working around the city, she found herself elbows deep in assisting with the diagnosis and first response treatment of dozens of patients. Most of the wounds she had seen to this point were minor, lacerations along with the odd broken bone, and all treatable with nominal effort. More serious cases, including life-threatening issues, were being handled by Dr. Varzhdinsky, as well as physicians from the hospital. None of those people were around at the moment, leaving Giorgio to deal with what her trained but not expert eyes told her was a serious injury.
"Commander," said a voice behind her, and Giorgio looked up to see Ensign Drelax, one of the medics pulled from the Starbase 11 staff and hurriedly assigned to the Narbonne's relief team.
He was a Denobulan, and his pale complexion and the pronounced ridges framing his face set him apart from the humans comprising the bulk of the people packed into the hospital's halls and waiting areas. Drelax was carrying a field medical kit slung over his shoulder, which he unlimbered and set on the floor as he took a knee next to Giorgio and the injured man.
"He was next to the window when the brick came through," reported Giorgio. "Definite skull damage. Could also be intracranial hemorrhaging."
The amount of blood coming from the wound worried her. She reached for Drelax's medical kit, expecting to find a portable diagnostic scanner. Resting one hand on the man's arm, Drelax replied, "I think you're right." The ensign's tone was crisp and professional, foregoing ranks and protocol as his medical training and the patient before him pushed aside all other considerations. "Help me get him to a treatment room." No sooner did Giorgio move to help lift the man than she felt his entire body go limp. There was a final, pitiful exhalation, and she knew in that moment that they were too late.
"Damn it!"
The fatigue of the past hours pushed the words from her lips before she even realized she was speaking. Without thinking, Giorgio shifted herself in order to leverage the man up and onto her shoulders in a firefighter's carry before heading at a trot toward the treatment rooms. She heard Drelax behind her running to keep up.
"Commander, I'm afraid he's gone."
She knew he was right, but the anger at having watched the man killed before her eyes, in the corridor of a hospital no less, drove her onward. Reaching the treatment room, she saw it was unoccupied, and she lowered the man onto the treatment table. Once he was prone, lying face up, there was no denying that he had passed. His eyes, thankfully, were closed, and she found herself transfixed by the wound and blood marring the right side of his head, face, and neck. From behind her, she heard Drelak say, "I'm sorry, Commander. His injury was just too severe." Two nurses, a man and a woman, both looking as tired as Giorgio felt, entered the room. The woman looked to the unmoving man.
"We just got the call about this. Is he..."
Giorgio shook her head.
"There was nothing we could do. It was just too fast."
Stepping aside, she allowed the nurses to inspect the man's unmoving form.
"It happened almost right in front of me."
"A woman outside the hospital was hit the same way," replied the male nurse.
"They're rushing her into surgery. It looks like security's getting the situation under control." He sighed as he looked down at the dead man. "Too late, unfortunately." Activating the patient bed's anti-gravity controls, his companion lifted the bed from its frame and began guiding it toward the door.
"We'll take care of him, but we're going to need this room."
"Understood." Giorgio watched the two nurses maneuver the bed out of the room and disappear down the corridor, swallowed by the constant stream of people heading in all directions toward points unknown. A moment later, she heard the sound of something heavy falling against the wall, and she turned to see Drelax sitting on the floor.
"Are you all right?"
she asked, moving toward him. The Denobulan's brilliant blue eyes seemed to be staring at nothing. His lips moved, but Giorgio heard no words. Crouching beside him, she touched his shoulder.
"Ensign?"
The touch seemed to bring him out of his trance, or whatever it was, and he blinked several times in rapid succession before looking at her. His jaw was slack, and his eyes were watering.
I'm sorry, Commander. I don't know what just came over me.
When was the last time you ate or got any sleep?"
Blinking some more, Drelax replied, "I arrived here yesterday evening with the first group of medics from the ship. I'd been working since then." He frowned. "I don't understand why I'm so tired. Denobulans can go far longer than a single day without the need for sleep."
"We are all working much longer and harder than normal, Ensign. Stress only contributes to our fatigue, so we have to remember to take care of ourselves. You should know that."
Realizing she was in danger of lapsing into full command mode, Giorgio softened her tone.
"I know it seems a bit overwhelming, but if we start collapsing, we're no good to anyone here."
Drelax nodded.
"You're absolutely right, Commander. It's just... I'm still having a problem processing all of this."
When she did not reply right away, he added, "As I've been treating patients, it's impossible not to listen as they talk about what they've been through, what happened before we arrived. Even with the evidence right in front of me, it's still so hard to believe."
"You've never been involved with something like this, have you?"
Giorgio asked.
"Only mock training exercises. Starbase 11 is my first duty assignment since graduating the academy and medic training. I'm supposed to be spending a year getting practical experience treating real patients while learning from the Starbase medical staff."
Giorgio resisted the urge to observe that he was getting far greater experience here than he would while working at a Starbase, but such a comment felt inappropriate at the moment.
"I wasn't born on Denobula," Drelax continued. "My parents were scientists living at the Federation colony on Arveda III. We were among a very small number of non-humans, but it was a wonderful place to live. I have so many friends there, and so many happy memories."
He closed his eyes, drawing a breath.
"I can't stop thinking about something like this happening there. My parents. My friends. The idea of them being forced to..."
The sentence faded, and he placed a hand over his mouth.
"I'm sorry, Commander.
It's okay. I want you to get some rest."
Seeing the look on his face and knowing he would protest, she held up a hand.
"Just a couple of hours. You don't have to leave the building.
Use the rooms we've set up as break areas for our people. I'll personally come and get you if I need help with something, and get something to eat. You need to keep up your strength. Aye, aye, Commander. Accepting her extended hand, he pushed himself to his feet. And thank you. Thank you for your hard work, Ensign. If we're going to tackle all of this, we're going to have to keep working. Don't burn yourself out too quickly. Nodding in understanding, Dreylax gathered his medical kit before leaving the room, presumably in search of the rooms designated for Narbonne personnel to catch brief respites from the ongoing work.
A nap sounds pretty damned good right now.
No sooner did the errant thought cross her mind than Georgiou forced it away. Despite the gentle lecture offered to Dreylax, there were still a number of things she needed to check on before resting. She needed to get updated reports from her various team leaders, not just here at the hospital, but at other key locations around the city, and she also was due to provide Captain Koropati with an updated status report.
If I can't sleep, I can at least have the biggest cup of coffee I can find.
Giving the treatment room a last sad look, Georgiou shook her head and straightened out her uniform before moving back into the hallway. The crowd here was thinner than she remembered, and the commotion from minutes earlier seemed to have subsided. There were faint sounds of shouting, likely coming from somewhere outside the building, but the situation in here had returned to its previous level of controlled chaos. The hospital was constructed as four structures, each containing five levels and connected by a central hub. On patient treatment floors, these junctions contained the nurses' stations and doctors' offices. As Georgiou made her way toward the second-floor nurses' station, she caught sight of a uniformed colony security officer standing outside one of the patient examination areas. The man, who looked like he should be studying for a high school test rather than standing guard, noticed her approach and his posture stiffened.
"Commander Georgiou?" he asked.
"That's right." She indicated the exam room's closed door.
"What's going on?"
The security officer, whose name tag read Cushman, replied,
"I'm on escort detail. I was told to wait outside until a doctor came to see this patient."
"What patient?"
Moving past the guard, Georgiou reached for the keypad next to the closed door and pressed the control to trigger the chime alerting the person inside that they were about to receive a visitor. A moment later, the door slid aside, and she found herself staring at a young human girl sitting on the edge of the room's single patient examination table. The child was perhaps 7 or 8 years old, with blonde hair pulled back into a ponytail. Her clothes, dark pants and a red shirt, were soiled, and her left pants leg was ripped from the cuff up to the middle of her thigh. Two pieces of what looked like plastic slats were secured on the inside and outside of her leg in a field expedient splint. Sitting next to her on the table was a stuffed doll that resembled an Andorian, its blue skin faded and worn, and one of its two antennae hanging limply from its head. A data slate rested in the girl's lap, its screen dominated by the graphics of some kind of game. She looked up at the sound of the door opening and smiled at Georgiou.
"Hi."
"Hello,"
replied Georgiou as she stepped into the room.
"What's your name?"
"Shannon. Shannon Moulton."
"I'm Philippa. What happened to your leg?"
"My mommy says I broke it when I fell down some stairs."
Still outside the room, Cushman said, "All of the hospital's bone knitters are being used, both here and at the school triage site. A few are broken, so the others are stretched thin. Shannon's mother went to find a doctor."
"Does your leg hurt?"
asked Georgiou, her gaze still on the girl. Shannon shook her head.
"It did before, but not now. A nurse gave me something to make it feel better."
"Well, we'll get you fixed up."
After the incident with the poor old man, it was nice to be able to offer attention to someone she might be able to help.
"Are you a doctor?"
Georgiou smiled.
"No, I'm just someone helping the doctors."
"Okay."
Satisfied, at least for the moment, the girl returned her attention to her data slate. Stepping closer, Georgiou reached for the doll.
"What's your friend's name?"
"Vran."
Shannon's eyes were wary as she watched Georgiou handle the toy.
"He's supposed to bring me good luck, but I guess he's not working today.
Maybe he's just confused.
Giorgio indicated the spot where the broken antenna hung from a piece of torn fabric. A portion of the doll's stuffing protruded from the small opening.
Once we get your leg taken care of, I can probably fix this for you.
Okay.
Commander. Looking to where Cushman still stood in the hallway, Giorgio saw that he was joined by a human woman. Despite her tired, worn expression, the resemblance to Shannon was obvious.
Hello. I'm Commander Giorgio, from the...
The Narbonne.
Yes.
Stepping into the room, the other woman extended a hand.
I'm Eliana Moulton, Shannon's mother. Thank you for being here, Commander.
Offering a weak smile to her daughter, she added,
Maybe you'll have better luck finding a doctor for us.
She even sounded tired when she talked.
I'm sure we can do that.
Looking to Cushman, Giorgio said,
Would you please see about that?
Cushman glanced at the other woman before replying, I'm sorry, Commander. With all of the riots and other problems, I'm really not supposed to leave Dr. Moulton or her daughter. Frowning, Giorgio said,
I don't understand. Council members and advisors have been given security escorts,
answered Moulton.
Those of us who are still alive, I mean.
Colony security is worried that people might try to come after us as retaliation for what happened.
You're on the leadership council?
Moulton grimaced.
I'm an advisor. Specifically, I'm an agricultural scientist. I work with other scientists to better understand the planet's ability to be farmed for both indigenous and imported seeds and crops.
So, you're one of the people who can help us identify and eradicate the fungal contamination?
Identify?
Yes.
Shame and regret clouded Moulton's features.
Eradicate is another thing, though.
Giorgio knew that Governor Kodos had included members of the council and others like Eliana Moulton in the roster of colonists he sentenced to death. But how or why had this woman survived?
You obviously know about the contagion, said Giorgio.
Again, Moulton's gaze shifted to look down toward the floor.
Oh, yes. I know a lot about it, for all the good it did.
13. Excerpt from The 4000, Crisis on Tarsus IV. Transcripts and visual recordings of Governor Ribeiro and the 12 elected members of the colony's council depict a leadership team gripped by uncertainty. Although things had not yet descended into chaos, events had served to push Ribeiro and her trusted advisors to the precipice. Exploring all possible means of containing the plague wreaking havoc on colony food supplies was beginning to place a strain on resources, personnel, and emotions. This much was obvious to Dr. Eliana Moulton as she stood before the governor and the council, armed with information she knew they would not want to hear.
Looking at the numbers wasn't going to change anything,
she says, as the two of us sit on the front porch of her home on Midas V, a long-established, thriving Federation colony world.
I'd done the computations 5 times. I remember staring at them, willing them to change, or for my math to be completely wrong. But it wasn't. Numbers are merciless, the way they present cold, harsh truth. And it was this truth that I had to present to Governor Ribeiro and the others.
She shakes her head.
I remember thinking it was a lot like having to give a patient a terminal diagnosis. There was just no way to make what we'd found come off sounding anything less than what it was. Dire.
Being a scientist, Moulton delivered the unwelcome news the only way she knew how, by presenting the facts and the supporting evidence as collected by her and her colleagues. According to their research into its origins and rate of expansion, Moulton and her people determined that the fungal contamination was the result of extreme reactions by the Tarsus IV soil to seeds and crops imported from the beleaguered colony on Epsilon Serona II. Despite a battery of tests to ensure compatibility, something in the genetic makeup of the foreign seeds responded to the new environment by mutating into something never before seen. At first, the change was small and undetectable,
and by the time the initial oddities were noticed by farmers preparing to harvest crops, it was too late. Within days, the contamination was raging out of control, defying all attempts to stop its advance using every measure at the colony's disposal. The fungus seemed possessed of its own consciousness, advancing from farm to farm, at first contained to New Anchorage and the areas in close proximity, but scientists like Moulton quickly learned that even outlying villages were falling victim to contamination. Other plant life was affected, but not to the extent suffered by food crops. Only scorching entire fields and greenhouses with phaser fire eradicated the infection, but it was a localized solution. Worse, raw compounds, such as those used in food processors, were also being exposed to the contagion, and they were carrying the contamination into the inner workings of the machines that took those compounds and created edible offerings for the population. Only quick thinking on behalf of Moulton's people and others working to confront the mounting crisis saw to it that the colony's remaining food supply escaped infection. Even as she stood before the council, work was underway to move uncontaminated food stores to protected locations around the city, namely pressurized storage facilities at the colony's main spaceport. Such measures were helpful, but they did not represent a solution.
"We were in trouble," says Moulton,
sipping tea she made by hand for us to enjoy during the interview.
"The steps we were taking were keeping existing supplies free of infection, but until we found a way to eradicate the infection, we couldn't grow any more.
We also had to clean food processors. I'm talking disassembling them down to the smallest piece, scrubbing them clean with decontamination gels and whatever else we had on hand or could dream up from raw materials.
Even that was only a temporary fix, because unless you can run those systems in an airtight chamber, they'd still be susceptible to being contaminated all over again."
She shakes her head, the frustration in her voice evident even after 10 years.
"And with all of that, the council still seemed to be having trouble believing the crisis was not only real, but out of our control. Every test we ran, everything we tried in order to develop a counteragent, came up negative. Within 2 days, every farm had been razed by phaser fire, and every greenhouse emptied down to the bare metal walls and floors. That stopped the immediate problem, but it's not as though we could start growing new crops. We needed to stop the contamination, erase all traces of it, or we risked just giving it a second chance to hammer us all over again."
Once Governor Ribeiro and the Leadership Council were convinced of the immediacy of the threat and the problems it was creating, attention turned to what else could be done. One obvious first step was to call for help, so a distress call was dispatched to Starbase 11, which, in addition to its considerable Starfleet presence, also included offices and representatives from the Federation's Department of Colony Support. So far as Ribeiro was concerned, the crisis gripping Tarsus IV rose to the level of planetary emergency.
"That's when we got the bad news."
Moulton offers that simple observation free of sarcasm or other negativity. Like so much the scientist has said, the comment is delivered without emotion and in matter-of-fact fashion.
"Help was available, but it was a month away. At first, that seemed ridiculous. But then you remember that Tarsus IV was quite some distance from Starbase 11 or other inhabited planets. Starfleet only has so many ships available in any given sector, and space is really, really big."
She laughs, but it's a laugh devoid of humor.
"People tend to forget that part.
Warp drive is great, but it still takes time to get from place to place."
"Even so, that wasn't what was working against us so much as the simple lack of ships. The starships assigned to Starbase 11 were deployed for various reasons. We learned later that a couple of them were dealing with issues relating to our always interesting relations with the Klingon Empire. Others were sent on missions that, as far as I know, are still classified."
Further questions aren't needed at this point, as Dr. Moulton is content to keep talking without additional prompting. She pauses only to refill our tea before continuing.
"So there we were,
facing at least a month before help might arrive. Admiral Anderson at Starbase 11 tried to put a positive spin on things, noting that he'd recalled certain ships from their other missions in order to warp back to help us. Her voice then turns conspiratorial. There were rumors that the ships that ended up arriving so soon after the